the buzzer. McCord on its way.
Oh my goodness.
They have to get it. With no timeouts, they do.
Courtside with Greenberg and Dokic, the definitive college basketball podcast.
I'm excited to welcome in Jay Billis to the world's greatest podcast, minus Dan Dokic. He is in Florida, sunning his dome, as he's a member of the Ball Brotherhood. But Jay, before we get into it, you know, we're watching all these games. You've been on sightseeing a zillion games. And, you know, one thing that's driving me crazy is I watch these teams, and they haven't had as much practice, and they haven't had the summer to really get a feel for some of their team's identities, especially the younger teams. But it seems like everyone's trying to, quote-unquote, play positions basketball. And to me, it sounds good in recruiting, and it sounds good to talk about it, but it seems to me like so many teams are putting players in positions to expose what they can't do as opposed to what they can do. You know, you think about when you played, when I played, and even just good teams in general. The NBA, everyone has a role. Everyone plays to their strengths. You know, guys do what they do well. Have you noticed in the games you're at that guys are trying so hard to fit into the new norm of how basketball is supposed to be played that you're seeing more and more guys not play to their strengths?
I have seen that. I haven't seen it maybe as being as big of a problem yet. I'm probably cutting them a little bit of slack. And you are too. I mean, but sort of the idea that people are trying to figure out some things in a difficult period where they haven't had their normal opportunity to figure things out. You know, no exhibition games and practice has been truncated and things like that. And availability of players has been difficult. I was at Texas Tech recently, and I, you know, I think it's kind of fascinating for a coach like Chris Beard that likes to run motion offense. You know, back in the day when you ran Bob Knight's motion, that's all you ran. There were no play calls. And the only difference was Knight might move a player around to put him in a different spot on the floor, or find a different matchup, or maybe a different action that he wanted to exploit. But you really almost can't give a team license to say, all right, you know, all these young guys that we're integrating, go out and run motion and make all your own decisions. And you're not going to have any set play calls. I think you almost have to do that. I mean, I'm not sure whether you're talking about this one, but early on in the season, I was up in the bubble in Connecticut and was watching Virginia. And, you know, I noticed, well, they're running a lot of five out motion and stuff I'd never seen Tony Bennett do before, even when he was at Washington State. And I think he was trying to take advantage of some of the sort of the versatile bigs that he had and guys that could shoot and maybe stretch the floor a little bit. So they got away, you know, they weren't running their sides offense, the mover blocker stuff. And that it sounds like that's what you're getting at. But I think he's gone back to more of what he was doing.
I think
before.
Last one game.
Yeah. And that's okay. I mean, you know, we're not football, which is great. Because we, you know, it's not, you don't have to worry about if you lose one game, you're out. And so I guess with the game being younger now than it's ever been, we're probably going to see more of that. And maybe, you know, it's an interesting point, Seth. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it this way that as the game is evolving, you know, do you try to get too far ahead of it, rather than, as you say, stick to what you're good at? Because you can get away from what your identity is, because those players came there because of your identity. And that's what's one of the difficulties of being a coach. I mean, I can't imagine how hard it is to be a coach right now, with, you know, having to take care of the players' needs that are greater than ever because of the pandemic. And then, you know, you're preparing for a game, not knowing whether the game's going to even happen or if the opponent is going to be there when the game starts, and you're going to have somebody else that you wind up like, I saw Louisville the other day, and, you know, I give Louisville a lot of credit for going to Wisconsin when they easily could have pulled the plug on that and said, you know what, we don't have enough players to do this. And they played anyway and didn't make any excuses. They took a pretty good beating, but Chris Mack didn't make a single excuse. And I was impressed by that.
Yeah, I think, you know, all those issues, like talking to Bayheim, they're shut down for the second time. It's up to Danny Hurley. They've had 14 practices, 45-day opportunities to practice, and they played Creighton the other day. And it, just the uncertainty, that's going on. I mean, like Jim said, they had a contact tracing with two players from Buffalo. Now they're testing their players every single day, and they haven't had any positives, but obviously they're shut down because of the state of New York. Have figured that out, but I think they've recruited to it is Gonzaga and Creighton. And Gonzaga obviously maybe even at a higher level. When you watch them go from transition to flow to ball and people moving, and obviously they got terrific players, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Fun. It's fun to watch. I think it's fun for the players, and then I think it's fun for the coaches. And you know Mark Few probably better than I do. And I remember one time talking to him about the way that they play. And there are so many teams now and coaches. And look, I'm not criticizing it. It's just there are some offenses that are just harder to watch, you know, because they tend to squeeze the life out of the ball and long possessions and all that stuff. And so I was talking to Fuey about that one time, and he had basically said, you know, one of the reasons they don't do that is that he's got to watch that stuff every day if he doesn't want to watch it. Now, it's easier to say when he's got so many great players now, like they've done such a good job over the years. Remember back in the day when he was first there after Dan Munson left and went to Minnesota, where Gonzaga was like the little engine that could. They had a bunch of skilled guards and they could shoot it and pass it. And they were gonna got to beat you that way. And then Mark Few and his staff got tired of getting beaten up on the glass by Michigan State and teams like that. So they realized they had to get more physical and tougher, and they adapted. And they went out and got bigger players, athletes, and all that. And now they're as talented as anybody. And they bring in transfers. The guys sit out, they get better over that year in their system so they can plug and play the next year. And it seems like they're newcomers and they're really not. They figured it out. And it's beautiful. Like, I just think that's one of the great success stories in all of sports. Not just that they win, but to me, I look at Villanova and Gonzaga, even though they're in very different circumstances, as two of the great success stories and two of the great cultures in not just in basketball, but in sports. And it's no surprise given the quality of person at the top of their flow chart in Mark Few and Jay Wright.
Yeah, both of those guys never get too high and never get too low. And they figured out, I think a great assistant understands who can play for your head coach. So they're not taking swings at stuff. Now, one guy, Jalen Suggs, to me, his strength, his size, his poise, his vision. Like I compare him a little bit to Jason Kidd in that he sees plays early, shoots it probably right now, probably releases it a little bit better. You know, at the same stage when Kidd, but he doesn't pass it like Jason Kidd. Jason Kidd was like a joke. But he's as advanced a leader and as poised as any of the great point guards I've seen in the last 10 years.
He's ridiculous. And when I saw some of the, he was the player of the year in Minnesota basketball and football as a quarterback. And you watch some of the things he did, like, I'm not Dan Orlovsky or anything or Greg McElroy trying to break down, quarterback play, but you watch him play as a quarterback and you're going, are you kidding me? Like it was stunning watching him sling the ball. And so to have an athlete like that, for Gonzaga, that's something they've not had before. They've never had a player like this before. And they've had super talented players. Like I asked Mark Few last time, okay, is this the most talented player you've ever recruited? And he said, well, Domantas Sabonis is pretty good. And so he put Sabonis up there. But this kid is probably more physically gifted than Sabonis, I would say. And to have that on that team full of super skilled, smart, tough players. And then Gonzaga has something that tell me if you agree with this. So I know they recruit talent and skill, but they recruit competitors too. And their ability to, like, Few calls them gamers. Like, this kid's a gamer. And their ability to spot gamers and value a gamer is up there with anybody's. So to your point, recruiting like Tommy Lloyd and their Brian Michelson, their whole staff recruiting to what what the program wants, yes. But their ability to spot guys that will compete, like everybody says they compete, but those like Suggs really does. And those guys, I think, really do.
Yeah. You know, Jimmy Lonimer, my brother was his assistant at St. Joe's. He would literally tell those guys, find me a two sport athlete that's a quarterback. And like they had 3 years in a row, all those really good St. Joe's teams, right? Their point guards were high school quarterbacks. And Jimmy actually, why he said, because they can bring people together. They know how to like lock into a huddle. They had to talk to their teammates. They had to be inclusive, which I thought was a really interesting thing, because basketball is a sport now that everyone's with their individual trainers. Yet if you have a guy who's been in a huddle and relying on those linemen to protect your ass so that you don't get the shit knocked out of you. I mean, I thought it was really interesting. That was almost like well ahead of it, but I just remember Bracco, Jimmy Lyon, he's telling me to try to find a point guard as a quarterback. And, you know, now we see this Jalen Suggs. It's amazing.
That's what – it's funny you say that, because I just did a Wisconsin game up in Madison, and Greg Gard was talking about that. Like, he really values high school football players when he's recruiting to basketball. And I think it's four. He's got four – players on his roster now that were high school quarterbacks. And he said something while we were up there that I hadn't heard a coach say before. He said, if you can handle 10 guys in a huddle, you can handle four. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good point. I'd never really heard it broken down quite like that. But he's also got the oldest team in America. I mean, his starting five goes 22 years old, 22 years old, 22 years old, 24, 24. I mean, two of those guys have had driver's licenses for 8 years. that's pretty good.
You saw that, but let's go to the other team that plays to me that actually has good flow, and that's Creighton. We watched him, and Kinkett is going to be really good, and Book Knight is legit. They didn't have Tyler Polley because he was waiting for his echo test because he had COVID, but they're going to be really good. But when I watch Creighton play. And obviously, we talk a lot about Zagorowski, and he has a great feel for having the game totally under control with his vision. But Bishop and Jefferson and Mahoney, I mean, those guys, you talk about toughness. Like to me, I don't know if they're X factors, junkyard dogs, but Danny Hurley and I were talking about they've got guys that have some dog in them. I mean, and dog in a good way, not dog in a bad way. That just, they don't give them. I mean, they're just competing and playing. To me, they remind me a lot of it of how Gonzaga was before they got these bigs.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's a really good comparison. I hadn't really thought about the comparison to Gonzaga, but you know, I think Creighton and Greg McDermott, you would probably say over the past several years, for the most part, their offense was ahead of their defense, and their offense was what made them really difficult to deal with. And that's still the case. But when I watched them play against Kansas at Kansas, because I had Kansas a couple days, you know, a few days after that game and at Texas Tech, and was really why I wound up being mesmerized by Creighton. Creighton should have won that game. They should have won in Allen Fieldhouse. They're legit. They're really good, and they're so difficult to guard. And I think they've gotten a little tougher defensively. They're harder to score upon, but they're going to be a factor. I mean, I think this year, you know, the Big Ten is so good. I'll be interested to see, like, the teams at the top of the polls right now, once they get into Big Ten play and start beating each other up, how they respond to losing when they played well enough to win. And does that take them down a peg and mean some of these other teams are going to be in better shape when they get to mentally, when they get to March? I don't know the answer to that. It could be that sort of the you know, 12 round fights you have every night in the Big Ten make you, I hate to say the word immune in today's society, but, you know, make you immune to, you know, feeling bad about yourself once you get to March and having any doubt. But I think Creighton, I don't want to say they can beat anybody. I mean, if they play their best, they can. But I think right now, I think if Gonzaga and Baylor play their best, I don't see teams beating them. At their best, you know, it's sort of the top few teams, if they play their best, and I might put West Virginia in there too, if West Virginia plays its best, I don't see a whole lot of teams beating them outside of the top three or four.
Yeah, to me, it's interesting. You talked about the Big Ten, but before we get to that, like, I think the amazing thing, real quickly, just a statement, what Fury's done with his schedule, if you think about the four teams he's going to play non-conference, they would have had Baylor to get in Virginia. So they get a Virginia Pac-Line team that's controlled tempo. They get West Virginia, a team that's physically dominant, and pangs you in the glass. They get Iowa, you know, who's a, you know, transition team with a low post player. They get Kansas, kind of a four out, spread you out, up and passing lanes. To me, again, it just happened, and he's got this great team. But how good is that for him to have these four games that he can look back to as he prepares for the NCAA? Well, he could end up playing any of these teams in the tournament. But just as to learn about his team, I thought that was really, really interesting for Fury in terms of being able to put this schedule together. But you get to the Big Ten, Rutgers, I'll tell you what, to me, they're like almost UConn back in the Jim Calhoun days 2.0. I mean, just the size of their backcourt, the physicality of their backcourt, that they can play the four kind of positionless guys together because Harper is so tough and physical. And I look at them and I look at them as a team I don't think I'd want to play against. Am I way off on that?
No. I mean, I think early on in the season when we would talk about teams, you know, you're doing a game or sitting in the studio and you're talking about teams, and you'd start rattling off Big Ten teams. You know, you'd go, you know, obviously, you know, go Iowa, Illinois, Michigan State. And then I think, I don't know, I haven't seen every one of yours, but I think we were saying, but watch out for Rutgers, you know, kind of as an add-on, like they're going to be difficult to beat. They could win the league. Like they could win the league. And I'm not saying like, look, this is their first year being top 10. So there's some stuff that goes with that we'll see. Once they get punched, they're going to get punched. Everybody in the Big Ten is going to get punched. And when they see their own blood, how are they going to react to it? Like teams that have been punched before, you know, kind of know how to do that. And I'm not saying they don't know, but we'll see. You know, I think they've got everything. Like Miles Johnson, I was so impressed with Miles Johnson. Like he's a vacuum cleaner. And he sets screens and he seems like he's willing to do all the dirty work and he's a non-complaining, low maintenance big guy. And Ron Harper Jr. is a star. Like he's become a star, a load carrying star. I think they've got what it takes to beat anybody. And you know, can they do it consistently over time? I think the answer is yes. But it's kind of fun watching a team like Rutgers that I think Pat Riley called it the innocent climb. Like they're in the innocent climb right now. And I don't know how high they're going to go, but after seeing them play early, I think when they're in film session, they got to be looking at each other going, well, I mean, who out there can we not beat? As long as they stay healthy in every way. I see really good things for them. They were way better. I thought they were going to be good. They're way better than I thought they were going to be. And I like it when that happens.
Montez Mathis and Jacob Young are just physical, tough specimen, hard playing. I mean, and you know, in talking to Steve, he's grounded, but confident, you know, I think he's tough, but you could tell he loves his team. Like you could just tell, and they love him back. I mean, they have a little bit to me of what Indiana football had this year.
Yeah.
And I mean, just watching them, I mean, just the interaction of the two, you know, are to me is really interesting. SEC, Tennessee, they had that long wait to play. They go score 100 twice in a row. Ridiculous depth. Not relying on freshmen, but those two freshmen. Yeah, Johnson, I watched a play, a block he made yesterday. It was the craziest block I've ever seen. It looked like LeBron. I mean, it was sick. Experience up front in Fulkerson. Josiah James a year later is better. Hans can guard anyone. Legitimate depth. Viscovi seems like he's taking better care of the basketball. In the hierarchy of these really good teams we're talking about, where do you see them?
I see them top 10 good. And I think like a lot of times with Tennessee, since Rick Barnes has been there, the the difference will be their offensive execution, that they've got every piece defensively, I think, that they need to be up with anybody. The question is, will they score efficiently? Because that's been frankly the problem, if you want to call it the problem. They don't have problems. You know, teams that are middling have problems, but it's just how high is the ceiling for them? And I think this team scores easier than some of his teams in the past few years, and they can score from more positions. I'm a big fan of Yves Pons. I mean, I think he's got the ability to play a long time in the NBA because of his defensive versatility and his ability to rebound and run the floor, all those things. So I think if he takes the next step on the offensive end, they're going to be like, they're the best team in that league. Although Missouri is pretty darn good. Like, I didn't think I'd be saying this about Missouri. They're very good. And Kentucky's been disappointing. So there's an opening there. Like, I just don't see Kentucky pulling themselves out of this to be the best team in the league. That they'll pull them out. They'll pull themselves out of this to be more competitive. But I don't see going from 1-5 to winning the league. You know, what we say has no bearing on it. But you know, if I had my crystal ball doesn't portend as well for them this year. They're not as good as I expected.
Yeah, Kentucky. I think these younger teams, and they're obviously the epitome of the younger team. They can't play hard for a long period of time. They can't maintain it. I'm looking at your book behind you. A toughness to compete offensively, to get the shot they want, to take care. They don't have that elite guard that can just go make a play. I mean, they've got good players, but they've got good young players that, you know, it goes back to, I think people undervalue what a winning player is. Like a guy that's just going to do the stuff that you need to get done in a close game when it's that 4 or 5 possession swing area where it's, you know, a stop in a good possession, or you go down 4 and you got to have back-to-back good possessions. I just don't see them have that. You know, I don't know how good they're. He'll get them better. I mean, there's no doubt they'll get them better. But I think they're void. They need Keon Brooks for just no other reason that he understands where John's coming from, where these guys that have no idea. I love what you said about Missouri, though, because Kunze Martin with veteran guards and experienced players, this team reminds me of that Tennessee team he had. Mm-hmm. Just a hard outer shell, and they're going to draw a line in the sand. They're going to guard you. They got 8,000 Smiths on the floor, but Drew and Mark are really, really, I mean, just they got a toughness about him. Tillman, even though he gets in foul trouble, gives him a big body. You know, I love the Kobe kid. I really, really like, you know, for a sophomore, 6'7". So, you know, I like their team a lot. I actually think Tennessee and Missouri are the two best teams in the SEC.
Yeah, it's two teams that I think the difference in them especially some of the younger teams in the league, is the difference between playing and fighting. Like those guys don't go into a game ready to play. They go in ready for a fight. And now part of that is they've been in fights before and been bloodied up, and they know what it takes, to your point about Kentucky's freshman a little bit earlier. And, you know, that's valuable. You know, I don't know. I've been thinking about this a lot, Seth. I mean, I don't know whether we're seeing a shift right now in the game where, you know, young talent, young super talent, I mean, it's always going to be valued, but is it going to be valued the same way when older transfer players are more readily available than they were in the past? Are we going to see a shift, or is it going to be a balance for some of the teams? That's going to be interesting to watch, because you know, you are seeing some of the older teams that are performing at a really high level, and then some of the younger teams are struggling a little bit. Now, is that a 1 year thing, or is that going to be the long term trend? It'll be interesting to see how this thing plays out, because, you know, look, transfers don't always work out either. Freshmen don't always, nothing always works out, but there's no avenue of life where you would rather have inexperience rather than experience. Like, if I'm on an airplane and the airline comes in and says, hey, we've got this unbelievably talented pilot, but it's his first flight, and we're really looking forward to what he's going to do in the future. Like, I'm going, I'd rather have the experienced pilot. I'd rather have him or her that's been through a ton of flights before. You know, there's nothing we'd rather have inexperience over experience, but I'll be interested to see whether the transfer trend overtakes the talented freshman trend we've seen.
And we're going to see it. Like I had a conversation with Mick Cronin the other day. It was pretty funny. Mick is only Mick could be because he just cracks me up. But it was actually after the first weekend of the season. Like, so first weekend, we're getting through the whole start of the season, gets pushed back, and he calls me at, it was like dawn. It was like, for him, it was dawn. It was like 9 in the morning, 6. He goes, I got to tell you something. So what's that? He goes, 3 days into the season, I've gotten calls from 3 guys that we recruited last year we didn't get who are ready to transfer already. He goes, this is going to be insane. He got the call Saturday. So the season started Wednesday, I think, the 25th. So 25th, 26th, 27th. So he waited. I can see Russell waited today because it was Sunday morning. And I'm like, the phone rings and now I'm like doing something in here and it's Mick. And like, he's on the West Coast. What's going on here? So, I mean, you're right. I think that's going to be interesting. And I think the other thing is, I think it's harder and harder because you got the G League Academy and all that. These kids that are really talented and freshmen, and they are really talented, they're really gifted. Do they really, I mean, they want to play college basketball, but they really want to get to the league. You know, so, I mean, like, you know, they're very much now because of the way things are going to, well, maybe it'll change, that they're almost visitors in a lot of ways where they don't get that same, and especially this year because the summers were so goofy. I think we got to take a step back and say, is it just because of this year? Because they didn't have the same summer and the same experience at the same time. And, you know, so I'm not sure we're going too far ahead, but it is going to be interesting because that rule is going to pass. And that's going to be a greater premium than I think signing all the late guys that are signed late are going to be transfers.
Yeah. So a couple things on that. So as to the point Mick Cronin was making, like, I'm okay with players that have an attitude of not wanting to wait their turn. Like, you know, there's an old school thought about, you know, back in the day, players came in and they expected to be a reserve and wait their turn and pay, you know, the old pay your dues thing. I'm okay with having expectations to play right away. My thing isn't about, you know, they're not willing to go through adversity or all that stuff. It's sort of the idea that I think players today know what to say more than they ever have before. Like, they know exactly what to say. So they all say, well, I'm a competitor. All right. Well, if you jump into a situation in college, I don't care whether you want to get to the league in 6 months or that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. Want to do it. But right now you said you wanted to compete. So compete. Now the coaching staff thinks the other guy's beating you out. That's why the other guy's playing. Not because we don't like you or not because we want you to wait your turn. That guy's better right now. And if you want to play, play better. You know, that's why decisions are made. Now, if you think the coach is wrong or something, and I just don't know that many coaches that are going, you know what, this guy's better, but let's not play him. Like, that just guys don't do that. And or at least not very many. And if they do, they don't. The players always last longer than them. So, you know, like I just think, like, compete. That would be my thing. If you want to play, compete, and you'll, if you win the job, you'll play. You know, no coach puts players on the floor with the intention of not being their best at that moment. They may take you out for a rest, but they're, you know, most of the time, if they want you on the floor, they'll call a timeout to get you rest. You know, they're not taking you off the floor if you're too valuable to take off.
No doubt. And the famous words of Brad Greenberg when he was my assistant, I'd go to make a substitution. He'd go, why are you putting that guy in? I'd say, because, you know, so-and-so, yeah, I want to get him some run. He goes, he's not even close to being as good as the guy you're taking out. He would literally put his hand on my shoulder. Why would you take him out?
That's what you get for hiring your brother.
I know. Literally, we walk back in the office. Can't believe that guy. He played 40 minutes. He should be able to play 40 minutes. Which, you know, makes sense. another team. Let's go out west. Forget about UCLA for a second. Oregon, to me, Dana Altman. Like, they get LJ Turner, algebra, which is obviously Jake agrees, and so does Quinn.
We've got your dogs fans.
We've got dogs in stereo today. But what he does, whether it's the Williams kid, the transfer from Duquesne, I mean, he has the uncanny ability, the Hardy kid from Vegas, I mean, hey, to take all these different players
in a
very short period of time. Kind of like Beard. Beard's great at it also, you know, from his, you know, ABA, South Carolina Warriors days and all that. But have you ever seen a guy that's been able to do that and get those guys to play really good basketball, replacing a Peyton Pritchard? But they seem to me like the best team in the Pac-12.
Yeah, I'm going to see them against UCLA coming up. And one of the things that Dana Altman's always impressed me with is this time of year. So it seems like, without exception, from the time I really got to know him when he was at Creighton through now, like, he's the winningest coach at two different schools, Creighton and Oregon. That's extraordinary. So, but usually during the holiday period, after the first semester and before the start of the second semester, when you can practice more, his teams get leaps and bounds better. You know, they take advantage of that time, and it's been consistent. If you go back and look, it's been consistent over the course of his career. You know, they just got a bad break with Nfali Dante going down for the season against Portland. He hurt his knee, so he'll be down. And that's a bummer, because he, you know, he's a rim protector for them and somebody in the middle. And but I think they're gonna be, if not the best team. The one team in the Pac-12 that I think is being maybe undervalued is Stanford. Stanford's very good, and I think they're getting better too. They perform pretty well in Maui overall. That kid Zaire Williams is the real deal. He's really good. And, you know, Oscar Da Silva's grown into an outstanding player, as an upperclassman, Bryce Wills, the whole thing. I think they've got the ability. I think they could win the league. I don't know that they will, but they'll be heard from. And I think as Williams gets better and better, and he's going to keep, that's the scary part, is that kid is ridiculously good and he's getting better. I think Jared Haas has a really nice ball club and a real chance this year.
You know, one concern, Tyrell Terry, I thought, brought everything together. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought that, you know, he could score and he could come off ball screens and make shots. He could get in the lane. And even though he's a thin kid, he could kind of play to contact and distribute it. Deshaun Davis, obviously a little bit different, a different guard, that probably not as creative, probably better defender. But yeah, I think they're really good. And I think Colorado is sneaky good because of McKinley Wright and Batty and their ability to make shots. I just think Pat Boyle is just a terrific coach. But they just fascinates me in that. And he's done it differently than he did it at Creighton, because he did it at Creighton, obviously, with more four-year guys and, you know, developing players. And obviously, it was in a different league. But their ability to get these transfers and then get them to buy in and then kind of supplement them with the right high school kids, to me, is, he's really good. Any concerns, like, you see Florida State go down, you know, Michigan State go down. Is that part of pandemic fatigue? Is that part of, like you said, Michigan State, Rocket Watts? Like, I thought Rocket Watts didn't even look like he was engaged in the game. I'm not sure you'd ever see Cassius Winston like that. You know, Florida State, playing all those guys, and I do think Kupovica is really been really good, and I think they're going to be terrific. But what do you get from some of these kind of head scratchers early?
I think part of it is just basketball. That, you know, I think we could go back and look at a number of different losses that teams have had over the years that like you said, are head scratchers that don't seem to make sense when you line up how good the teams are versus one another. You know, I think I watched the Michigan State Northwestern game. One, Northwestern's good.
They were terrific.
And yeah, they're good. But, you know, the last time I think that Michigan State lost to Northwestern as a top five or six team was in 1979. They wound up winning the national championship that year. It was Magic, Kelser, that whole group. So, you know, you have wins and losses like that don't seem to make sense. Wins on the underdog side and losses on the favorite side. And there are always reasons for why you lose during the course of a year. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out. I don't know that we're ever going to figure out the stress level and how that's impacting players because of COVID. I feel it as a broadcaster when you're going to these games, that there's a stress level traveling to a game and then even going to the game, that you're not sure up until it tips that the game's going to go off. Like, I've had games already where the day of the game, they were concerned whether the game was going to get played that afternoon or that evening. And we already saw, like we saw a day or two ago, a women's basketball game got canceled at halftime. And you're going, you know, that's coming. I mean, that's not going to be a stranger to a men's game, because they have the same protocols, men's and women's. So that stress level, I think, does get to the players and probably indicates that, you know, once in a while or here and there, there are going to be mental preparation slip ups. I think we're going to see it, but I'm not worried about, you know, Michigan State losing because they've lost before and won national, you know, like won the championship, or they've lost before and reached the Final Four like that. Sometimes those can be good learning experiences for a team, and especially a team trying to figure it out, because they're not, just because they've had players there before, they lost a lot last year and lost a lot of leadership. They still have to figure it out. You know, the experienced players have to figure it out too and figure it out together.
How much different is it calling, because I'm just in the studio, calling a game from your house or from Charlotte, and calling a game up in a balcony with the separation between you and Dan or you and whomever you're doing the game? How different is it in terms of just the feel of the game?
Well, relative to what we're used to. So relative to a pre-COVID game, it sucks. It absolutely sucks. Both calling it at home and being in the arena. But I'm not just saying this, Seth. I mean, you know, not that I didn't have great appreciation for what our colleagues do every day, but that's been sharpened because of COVID. Like, our bosses that deal with scheduling and all these things, they're superstars to have to deal with what they're dealing with. Like, our job has been impacted and we've had to adapt and overcome some things, but it's minor compared to what our colleagues do behind the camera. So I've been blown away by the job they've done. But when you're sitting there doing the game, when you're there, the atmosphere is antiseptic. So there's a surreal part of it. Then, you know, you can't interact with people the way you normally do. So if you're talking to the coach, you're a long way away. And then there's no, you know, obviously no fans. So it's really an eerie feeling to walk into an empty building with your suit and with your coat and tie on and ready to do a game. Parking's easier, but that's about the only thing that's better. The games from home, when you're doing it from a studio, it's way different because you feel like you're not, you know, you're gonna, you feel like you might miss something important. And the thing I fear most, it's not just a concern, it's actually a fear, is that if something happens during the game, if you have a near tragic situation like Chris Spatola had with Florida State when Keontae Johnson went down, and thank God he's improving and doing better, how do you process something like that when you're not courtside and you don't have access to the same information? So we're all trying to figure it out, but, you know, the travel and all that is so different. I've never been, like, the quietest place I am right now is on an airplane. Nobody talks. It's crazy. I understand it, but it's something we're all, and look, we're all processing it at the same time. But you know, you still have to. I'm still trying as best I can to keep a positive attitude. But this is different too, Seth. Like, the, you know, when you're in Cameron Indoor Stadium and somebody makes a great play, my instinct is to lay out for a while and let the crowd take it. Well, there's no crowd now. So now if somebody makes a steal and takes a dunk, you have to, like, now you have to react with some energy to let people know that excited me. The crowd used to do it before, and then you'd say something, you know, 20 seconds later. So that's an adjustment. We're trying to figure it out as we go. It's been really interesting.
Best cutout you've seen?
Best cutout?
Yeah, I mean, because that to me, in the studio, that's my favorite thing to ask. Like, who's at the game?
Yeah, Texas Tech so far has been the best. They have all these different Texas Tech folks and Texas people, and then they had Jennifer Aniston and J-Lo. And then some different people in between. So all the facial expressions were really funny. And then Mark Fox, the head coach at Cal, was playing at UCLA recently. And so sent me a video. He took video after their shoot around. You were there. So you were in the stands. Reese Davis and some other, you know, obviously a whole bunch of basketball people. And then he looked around and he's like, I don't see Billis. There's no Billis here. And he looked the whole thing. And I grew up in LA, and he's like, say no to UCLA, and they never forget it. UCLA wasn't worried about me, man. That's not why. It's just being irrelevant. That's all it is.
You're going to UCLA, Oregon?
I'm not going there. I'm doing that one from the studio. So that'll be a different feeling. But it'll be fun to see him. I'm talking with Dana Altman this afternoon on a Zoom meeting with all our crew. And then I spent some time on the phone yesterday with someone else at Oregon, trying to get sort of a little bit of inside stuff rather than just watch tape of him. I saw him last year. But the one thing I'm disappointed at more, I've never done a game, at Oregon. It's one of the few places. Yeah, I've never done a game at Oregon. I've never done one at the Pit in New Mexico, and I've never done one at Arkansas at Lloyd Hall, at Walton. And I want to do games from each one of those places before they fire me.
I think that's not going to happen. Arkansas is pretty good, actually. I think that kid Moses. Kid Moses Moody's good, and the Smith kid, the transfer from Indiana, is good, and Desmond Still. They're good. I tell you, and he's like the stuff he does on social. What Danielle does on social media is some of the funniest thing I've ever seen.
I love Musselman. He's just such a good dude, and what a coach, man. Those guys are like, you go to one of their game day shoot arounds, and they've got all these not whiteboards, but all these poster boards around with their scouting report all around the court, and you know, like, we didn't do that when I played. You know, we sat in the locker room, and the coaches told, we took notes and everything. And, you know, I'd look at some of my teammates' notes after a while going, we're screwed. Like, if that's what that guy wrote down, if that's what he took from that scouting report, we got some problems tomorrow.
Oh, that's good stuff. Well, I appreciate you doing this, man. That's good. And I will talk to you from the studio tomorrow, I guess, because I'm in, is it tomorrow, UCLA? Yeah, tomorrow.
Right? Yeah, UCLA tomorrow. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
We're in there for one game, one dynamic 6 minutes. You have a good 2 hours. I'm going to have my very best career, best 6 minutes I've ever had tomorrow.
Looking forward to hearing it.
The one time it's good.
Thank you for listening to Courtside with Greenberg and Dockage. You can listen and subscribe to all ESPN podcasts in the Listen tab of the ESPN app, including the latest from the NBA and the Hoop Collective podcast, available in the ESPN app or Apple Podcasts.